Hello, this is Mark Grier. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the December 4th issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, let's get started. First article. The furor over Trump's boat attacks and a particular follow-up strike explained. Bipartisan congressional oversight is underway, but for now is focusing on narrow details about one missile instead of a broader legal issue. The House and Senate Armed Services Committees are scrutinizing a September 2nd attack by the U.S. military on a speedboat in the Caribbean Sea that the Trump administration has claimed was smuggling drugs, and especially whether a decision to fire a second missile at the vessel, which killed two survivors of the first blast, was a war crime. The oversight effort is dissecting the specific orders of Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and the Special Operations Commander overseeing the attack, Admiral Frank Bradley. The Admiral and General Dan Kane, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, are scheduled to go to Capitol Hill on Thursday to answer questions about the strike. A broad range of legal experts argue that the killings have been murders. The Trump administration insists that its lethal campaign, including the second strike on September 2nd, is lawful. Here's a closer look. What is the boat attacks operation? President Trump has ordered the military to kill people on boats in international waters who are suspected of smuggling narcotics on behalf of drug cartels. Since September 2nd, the administration has announced 21 such attacks in the Caribbean Sea and the Eastern Pacific Ocean that have killed 83 people. This is a change from the longstanding U.S. approach of having the Coast Guard intercept such vessels and, if suspicions prove accurate, seize illicit cargoes and arrest people on board. The legality of the new policy has been widely disputed. What is the legal dispute? Well, the Trump administration says the operation is lawful because Mr. Trump determined that the United States is in a formal armed conflict with drug cartels, even though Congress has not authorized one, and that people suspected of running drugs are combatants. A Justice Department memo endorses Mr. Trump's claims and, relying on the premise that this is an armed conflict, says the suspected drug cargoes aboard the boats are lawful targets. Legal experts have rejected the idea that there is any armed conflict with drug cartels. The military is not permitted to target civilians who do not pose an imminent threat of violence, even if they are suspected of committing crimes. Why is the September 2nd attack now in focus? Basic facts about the September 2nd attack, including the boat had turned back before the attack, were reported that month. But since then, the administration has announced its disputed theory that the United States is in an armed conflict with cartels, and a group of Democratic lawmakers recorded a video telling members of the armed service that they could refuse illegal orders, prompting a furious White House response. Against that backdrop, on November 28th, the Washington Post published a more detailed account of the September 2nd attack. It said Admiral Bradley had ordered the second strike to fulfill a spoken directive from Mr. Hegseth to kill everyone, prompting bipartisan questions about war crimes. The administration has denied certain aspects of implications of that account. What makes the follow-up strike different? Well, even if one accepts Mr. Trump's claim that the United States is in an armed conflict and the boat attacks are generally lawful, the September 2nd follow-up strike might still be a war crime. The Pentagon's Law of War manual says that orders to fire upon the shipwrecked would be clearly legal. And while the administration has defended the entire attack, which killed 11 people in all, Mr. Trump has distanced himself from the second strike. He told reporters on November 30th that he thought the first strike was fine and that he wouldn't have wanted that, not a second strike. What seems clear? Well, it appears to not be in dispute that Mr. Hegseth was the target engagement authority who signed an executive order telling Special Operations Forces to sink boats, destroy their suspected cargo, and kill their crews. It also appears clear that he gave the go-ahead order to Admiral Bradley for the September 2nd attacks. Admiral Bradley, who was the commander in control of the mission, which was carried out by SEAL Team 6 operators, he gave them an order to strike the boat. After the smoke cleared, surveillance video showed the disabled vessel was still afloat and two people were still alive. He ordered follow-up strikes that killed them and sank the vessel. Were the initial survivors shipwrecked? Their boat was wrecked, but there is a complication. The Pentagon's Law of War manual says that to be considered shipwrecked, persons must be in need of assistance and care, and they must refrain from any hostile act. A Naval Commander Handbook says combatants qualify as shipwrecked persons only if they have ceased all active combat activity. Two U.S. officials have said the military intercepted radio communications from the survivors to suspected cartel members, raising the possibility that any drugs on the boat that had not burned up in the first blast could have been retrieved. The military, they said, interrupted the purported distress call as meaning the survivors were still in the fight and so were not shipwrecked. What did Mr. Hegseth order? Mr. Hegseth has denied that he ordered the killing of the two survivors, and officials have told New York Times that he gave his orders before the attack commenced and did not communicate further ones to Admiral Bradley when there turned out to be survivors. The officials said that Mr. Hegseth's execute order was explicit that the mission was a lethal one, but that it did not address what should happen if the first strike did not kill everybody. They also said he did not give a spoken directive. In a meeting with Admiral Bradley about the order that went beyond its written terms, it is not clear whether they spoke outside of that meeting. However, the officials also said Mr. Hegseth had reviewed and approved contingency plans the military had developed that include scenarios in which there were survivors. They described those plans as saying the military would attempt to rescue survivors who appeared shipwrecked and out of the fight, but would try again to kill the survivors if they committed hostile acts. What are the limits of this analysis? The laws of war were written for fighting between organized armies and armed combatants trying to kill each other. The rules do not fit attacks on small, unarmed boats suspected of smuggling cocaine, or address what counts as being in or out of the fight when the crews on the boats were not actually fighting anyone in the first place. Focusing on the shipwrecked is a distraction insofar as it suggests everything else preceding and after that strike was all legitimate, said Ryan Goodman, a New York University law professor and former Pentagon lawyer. even under a law of armed conflict, they were all civilians, and we are not actually in armed conflict. Either way, it was all murder. Okay, on to the next article. New York Times sues the Pentagon over First Amendment rights. The lawsuit said the Defense Department's new set of rules for journalists violates the Constitution's guarantees of due process, freedom of speech, and freedom of the press. The New York Times accused the Pentagon in a lawsuit on Thursday of infringing on the constitutional rights of journalists by imposing a set of new restrictions on reporting about the military. In the suit, filed in the U.S. District Court in Washington, the Times argued that the Defense Department's new policy violated the First Amendment and seeks to restrict journalists' ability to do what journalists have always done: ask questions of government employees and gather information to report stories that take the public beyond official pronouncements. The rules, which went into effect in October, are a stark departure from the previous ones in both length and scope. They require reporters to sign a 21-page form that sets restrictions on journalistic activities, including requests for story tips and inquiries to Pentagon sources. Reporters who don't comply could lose their press passes, and the Pentagon has accorded itself unbridled discretion to enforce the policy as it sees fit, according to the lawsuit. The suit said that reporting any information not approved by department officials could lead to punishment, regardless of whether such news gathering occurred on or off Pentagon grounds, and regardless of whether the information at issue is classified or unclassified. The complaint sought a court order halting enforcement of the rules and a declaration that the provisions targeting the exercise of First Amendment rights were unlawful. The Times has retained Theodore Boutros, a First Amendment lawyer who has argued major media access cases in federal court. Julian Barnes, a Pentagon reporter for The Times, is listed as a plaintiff alongside the company. The Pentagon did not immediately respond to requests for comment. The new rules are the latest step in a months-long effort by Pete Hegseth, the Defense Secretary, to curtail the access and privileges of the Pentagon Press Corps. Mr. Hegseth arrived at the Pentagon in January after a bruising confirmation process that surfaced allegations of excessive drinking and sexual assault, which he said were untrue. Early in his tenure, Mr. Hegseth proposed evicting from the Pentagon a veteran reporter at NBC News who had contributed to some of the coverage. The department later stripped several national news outlets of their workspaces in the Pentagon, offering them mostly to conservative outlets. Mr. Hegseth has also added limits on where reporters can roam in the complex. A draft of the new restrictions first emerged in September and was revised after pushback from lawyers representing news organizations. The final rules were released on October 6th, and more than a week later, dozens of credentialed journalists, including six from The Times, surrendered their badges instead of signing the document. The departing outlets have continued reporting on the military despite the access limits. Many major news organizations released statements in October condemning the Pentagon policy as an incursion on the First Amendment. The policy is without precedent and threatens core journalistic protections, said a statement from ABC News, CBS News, CNN, Fox News Media, and NBC News. In a press briefing on Wednesday, a senior Times lawyer said that there had been discussions with other news organizations about joining the suit, but that the newspaper had decided to proceed alone. The suit took issue with multiple provisions of the new policy, including one that empowered the Pentagon to deem a journalist a security or safety risk. Such a determination could hinge on whether the journalist engaged in unauthorized disclosure of classified information or certain unclassified information, among other considerations. The policy's wording on solicitation has been a particular worry for media lawyers. It asserts that the First Amendment does not protect reporters when they solicit government employees to violate the law by providing confidential government information, and could apply to calls for tips that encourage Defense Department employees to share non-public agency information. Providing channels for sources to send information, the suit said, was a routine practice for journalists. Legal clashes between journalists and the government over access to federal buildings have arisen repeatedly across President Trump's two terms. During his first administration, the White House pulled the press passes of two White House correspondents. The journalists regained those passes after litigation. This year, the Associated Press sued the government after being excluded from White House press pools events in cramped spaces such as the Oval Office. Litigation challenging that move is ongoing. In each of those cases, the government targeted one journalist or outlet for punishment. The Pentagon restrictions, on the other hand, seek to bind an entire press corps. And those restrictions, the suit argued, would suppress the work of news organizations with perceived viewpoints the department disfavors. After the departure of the legacy press corps, the Pentagon announced that a new group of outlets had agreed to the restrictions and would work from the press space in the building. The new arrivals featured an array of pro-Trump outlets that have echoed administration talking points and show little inclination to investigate its actions. All right, next article. The hepatitis B vaccine is under threat. Here's what's at stake. Rates of the disease have fallen since 1991, when all newborns began receiving the shot. An influential panel is scheduled to vote Thursday on eligibility for the vaccine. An influential advisory committee convening on Thursday may reverse a decades-old recommendation that all newborns receive the hepatitis B vaccine, which guards against an infection that can leave lasting liver damage. Since 1991, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Vaccine Advisory Committee has recommended that all newborns receive the hepatitis B shot. The panel later recommended catch-up vaccines for children who are not immunized as babies. It first recommended vaccine in 1982 for people who were at high risk. But some of the nation's top health officials and President Trump have cast doubt on a vaccine that doctors call life-saving. Health Secretary Robert Kennedy Jr. has repeatedly questioned whether babies should continue to receive the vaccine on their first day of life, arguing that the disease is mainly transmitted through sexual contact and sharing needles, but the virus can also pass from mother to child at birth. In September, Mr. Trump said that he thought children should not get the shot until age 12. Members of the CDC advisory panel, who were handpicked by Mr. Kennedy, were poised to vote on whether to limit the use of the shot in September, but postponed the decision after a confusing and often chaotic meeting. While most adults who contract hepatitis B will recover, young children who contract the disease are at far greater risk of becoming chronically ill. Babies receive 3 doses of the vaccine. The initial shot is given on the first day of life. Rates of hepatitis B fell sharply in the decades after the CDC's recommendations. Acute infections reported among children and teens dropped by 99% between 1990 and 2019. And while overall childhood vaccination rates have declined for years, rates of infant immunization against hepatitis B in particular do not appear to be fading. Still, Dr. Deborah Langlois, a pediatrician at University of Michigan Health Mott Children's Hospital, said that most weeks she speaks with parents who do not want their babies to receive the shot. How does hepatitis B spread? Well, hepatitis B, which can be up to 100 times more infectious than HIV, spreads when bodily fluids like blood and semen from an infected person enter someone else's body. The virus can pass from person to person through sex or shared needles, including equipment used for tattooing or piercing. An infected mother can pass hepatitis B to her baby through birth, and the virus can linger in microscopic traces of bodily fluids, meaning that specks of dried blood that end up on nail clippers, towels, toothbrushes, razors, or other items can be infectious for a week. It's not just the stigmatizing exposure, said Dr. Langlois. It can be everyday household exposures with a family member that doesn't know they have it. The disease has become relatively rare in the United States. The CDC estimates that about 640,000 U.S. adults have chronic hepatitis B, though many adults do not show symptoms. Hepatitis B is more common in other countries, especially in parts of Africa and Asia, in part because of low vaccination rates. The World Health Organization estimates that there are around 1.2 million new infections of hepatitis B each year globally. In 2022, the organization noted over 1 million people died after contracting the virus, largely because of liver complications. Antiviral drugs can help prevent liver damage, but there is no cure for the disease. Why do doctors recommend the hepatitis B vaccine at birth? Most pregnant women in the United States are screened for hepatitis B in their first trimester, but screening isn't perfect, and testing negative in the first trimester doesn't mean you cannot contract hepatitis B later on, said Dr. Amanda Kost, a family medicine doctor at University of Washington Medicine. Some research suggests as many as 14% of pregnant women may not get tested, which may be because of inadequate prenatal care or because they refuse the test. There's also a rare risk of false negatives. These screening gaps are one reason doctors recommend a first dose of the vaccine the day the baby is born. If a woman tests positive for hepatitis B during her screening, doctors will closely monitor her and sometimes administer an antiviral treatment during her third trimester. On the first day of life, her baby will receive the hepatitis B immune globulin, an injection that helps provide antibodies. This, along with the vaccine, can prevent transmission. Without these interventions, an infected mother is virtually guaranteed to transmit the virus to the baby, said Dr. Jamie DeVille, a pediatric infectious disease physician at the University of California at Los Angeles School of Medicine. Children who contract hepatitis B will develop either a short-term or a chronic infection. Short-term infections can last for a few weeks to several months. Most children under the age of 5 do not have symptoms. Those who do can develop jaundice, fatigue, nausea, vomiting, and muscle aches. but babies who are infected in the first year of life have about a 90% chance of developing a chronic infection. And about 30% of children infected between the ages of 1 and 5 develop chronic hepatitis B. Left untreated, chronic infections can lead to irreversible liver damage, scarring, failure, and cancer over time. These complications can be deadly. How safe and effective is the vaccine? Well, hepatitis B vaccine protects around 98% of healthy infants, according to the CDC. Many studies have shown that the side effects from the shots are typically mild and temporary and can include fatigue, headache, fever, or soreness at the site of the injection. Dr. Alyssa Hampton, a pediatric hospitalist at University of Virginia Health, said the first thing she asked patients who don't want to give their newborns the vaccine is, "Tell me your concerns." Often, they reply with some version of, "Why should I give this to my baby anyway?" "The answer I give is that it's a safe vaccine," she said. "It is very effective. And if you could start your baby's protection from this minute at birth, that would be what I recommend." You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, next article. A growing U.S. tech hub needs workers. Colleges try to keep up. The success of efforts to turn Phoenix into a dominant center of semiconductor manufacturing may hinge on efforts to train local workers. Leah Wickey was intent on forging a new career in a field that felt stable. A real estate agent in Phoenix, Ms. Wickey, 45, had endured booms and busts. Suddenly, there was an abundance of jobs in the computer chip industry. First, she needed to learn new skills. On a recent afternoon, she sat in a classroom at Mesa Community College, absorbing a presentation about the operation of equipment used to make computer chips. She was completing a 10-day certification program to help her land an entry-level job. "This has a future," Ms. Wickey said. As investment pours into Phoenix, financing the construction of factories for dozens of suppliers to Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company and other chip makers, the success of the effort may hinge on how effectively local people can be educated to the needed work. Excuse me. By one estimate, more than 115,000 local semiconductor jobs are expected to be created in the next 4 years, leading the mission special importance. A dozen years have passed since the last major chip factory, known as a fab, was built in the United States. People with the requisite skills are in short supply. TSMC, the company at the center of the semiconductor development in Phoenix, has been bringing in workers from its home market. The strategy has proved effective as a way for TSMC to quickly begin making chips in its new factories. Yet, longer term, the Taiwanese company will need large numbers of local people capable of stepping in. It has been working with area universities and community colleges to develop training programs. "We're dedicating a lot of money and resources to training," said Rose Consonares, president of TSMC Arizona, during an interview in Phoenix. "We're really, really interested in making sure that we're developing a workforce here." Part of the challenge in recruiting American workers is overcoming stereotypes of manufacturing as a relic of the past. For decades, business and political leaders in the United States have pushed finance over factories. Many people have an old-school thinking about manufacturing, said Benil Starley, who leads a school of manufacturing systems and networks at Arizona State University. It's highly automated now. Inside a science and technology building developed on a former Air Force base, he displayed a caged area used to test autonomous cars. In another area, miniature robots allowed students to simulate operating larger models. This is a great transferable skill, Dr. Starley said. These robots are everywhere. At another facility established in a former Motorola building, Arizona State students operate a fully functioning semiconductor fab. They team up with companies, including Applied Materials, a semiconductor equipment manufacturer, testing potential uses for the gear. If Arizona State is training the officers in the semiconductor campaign, the Maricopa Community College system is developing the foot soldiers. The system's 10 campuses and 31 satellite locations, including Mesa, have long worked with local companies to design certification and degree programs, equipping students with the skills needed for immediate jobs. Given the size of the investment in semiconductors, that industry has gained focus. There's certainly urgency to make sure that we understand their needs and will build the programs to fill the talent pipeline, said Valerie Jones, Vice Chancellor for Workforce and Development. Over the last 3 years, the number of students in the community colleges programs tied directly to semiconductor production nearly doubled to 964. More than 4,400 students are pursuing associate degree programs in engineering, an increase of 160% since 2022. Ms. Wiki was part of the surge. So was her classmate David Geist, 48, whose resume included a stint in radiation decontamination at a nuclear power plant, then 2 decades as a massage therapist. What the students shared was a yearning for something dependable. They had lived through a local foreclosure crisis, the rise of cryptocurrency, meme stock furors, and multi-level marketing shenanigans. Experts were describing artificial intelligence data centers as the next area of speculative excess. Yet, in one guise or another, chips seemed likely to endure. Ms. Wiki, who had looked at TSMC's website the night earlier and found a dozen job listings. The next morning, there were 2 more. Unless something drastic happens, semiconductors are going to be involved in the future, said Brody Pace, 22, another student at the class. Okay, next article. Trump to host Congo and Rwanda leaders for peace talks in persistent conflict. The president will meet with the leaders of Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo to advance a deal meant to end a long war in eastern Congo. President Trump will host the leaders of Rwanda and Congo at the White House on Thursday to advance a deal meant to end a devastating and persistent war in eastern Congo. Mr. Trump has repeatedly boasted of his administration's role in mediating a peace agreement between the two nations. It is part of his campaign to establish himself as a global peacemaker and a candidate for the Nobel Peace Prize. even as he has publicly derided Congo and other war-torn nations in Africa. After he hosts the president of Congo and the president of Rwanda in the White House, the leaders will hold a signing ceremony for the agreement's next phase at the U.S. Institute of Peace, which the administration has renamed the Donald J. Trump United States Institute of Peace. The president's victory lap could prove to be premature. On Wednesday, one day before the deal was set to be signed, heavy fighting was reported near the city of Uvira and the Rwandan border. Deadly conflict in eastern Congo has been unfolding over three decades, since the genocide in Rwanda's civil war in 1994. Violence has surged and embedded over the long span, and in recent years, Congolese officials have accused Rwanda of giving material aid to a powerful militia, M23, that was created in 2012 and launched a new round of attacks in Congo in 2021. M23 holds swaths of eastern Congo and has consolidated its power there this year, creating a parallel government that controls everything from mineral supply chains to garbage collection. The Washington deal relies on progress being made toward M23 giving up that power, something it has shown no sign of being willing to do. Peace talks in Doha between Congo and M23 have produced no consensus on issues, including the return of M23 held areas to Congolese government control, the disarmament of armed groups, and justice for victims, according to Critical Threats, a security think tank. Over 400 people, nearly 300 of them civilians, were killed in the past month in clashes between M23 and the Congolese military and allied militia, according to Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project. There are bullets everywhere. People are not safe, said David Kakuria, a civil society leader in the eastern South Kivu province, where fighting has recently escalated. People are dying needlessly because there are fronts almost everywhere. He cast doubt on the Washington meeting, spurring progress. What exactly are they going to sign, he said. Are they simply being hypocritical? Even though Mr. Trump has claimed to end the war, a spokesman for Congo's government acknowledged at a news conference on Wednesday that the agreement signed in June was simply a signature. The second part is the toughest, said the spokesman, Patrick Katabwambi. The implication of peace is the second part. When the foreign ministers from Congo and Rwanda last visited the White House to sign the earlier phase of the peace agreement, Trump welcomed the leaders with a celebrity tone. It was a sharp contrast from his typical language about African nations, and particularly Congo. Mr. Trump has repeatedly said, without evidence, that Congo is emptying its prisons and sending violent people to the U.S. border. In a meeting with the African leaders on Thursday, will come as Mr. Trump has repeatedly unleashed xenophobic language against the Somali community in the United States. Rwanda and Congo's governments have taken a conciliatory approach, crediting the Trump administration for attaching an economic component to the deal. Tina Salama, a spokeswoman for Congo's president, also raised the possibility that the Trump administration would want to discuss a new deportation deal during the meetings. The Trump administration has sent some non-African deportees to some African nations, a practice known as third country deportations in an effort to discourage immigrants illegally in the United States from staying. While it is hoping to secure investment from American companies, Congo will not hand over its critical resources to the United States, Ms. Salama had said. All right, next article. Trump pardons developer prosecuted by his own administration. This summer, Trump administration officials had lauded the indictment of Timothy Luwiki as an effort to root out corruption and unfair business practices. President Trump on Tuesday pardoned a real estate developer who had been charged by the president's own Justice Department earlier this year with rigging the bidding process for a sports arena. Mr. Trump's pardon effectively quashed his administration's effort to convict the developer, Timothy Luwiki, a founder and former chief executive of Oakview Group, for allegedly orchestrating a conspiracy to rig the bidding process for the Moody Center Arena at the University of Texas to benefit his own company. The maximum penalty for the charge was 10 years in prison and a $1 million fine. It was one of the latest in a series of high-profile pardons doled out by Mr. Trump. Earlier on Wednesday, Mr. Trump pardoned Representative Henry Cuellar, Democrat of Texas, who was awaiting trial on charges of bribery. Earlier this week, Mr. Trump pardoned Juan Orlando Hernandez, the former president of Honduras, who was prosecuted during the first Trump administration for leading a drug trafficking conspiracy. When Mr. Luwiki was charged in June, he stepped down as head of Oakview Group, and the company agreed to pay $15 million in penalties for its role in the arena scheme. At the time, Trump administration officials who had worked on the investigation hailed the indictment as part of a wider effort by the Justice Department to root out corruption and unfair business practices. The Antitrust Division and its law enforcement partners will continue to hold executives who cheat to avoid competition accountable, said Abigail Slater, Mr. Trump's pick to lead the Antitrust Division, in a statement in June. Justin Simmons, the U.S. attorney in charge of the case, who was appointed by Attorney General Pam Bondi, said in a statement around the same time that Mr. Luwiki had engaged in unfair business practices that make it very difficult for the American people to pursue prosperity like our founders intended. Christopher Rea, whom the FBI Director Kash Patel had appointed as Assistant Director in charge of the New York Field Office, also assisted in the investigation. In a statement at the time, Mr. Rea said that the FBI is determined to ensure that those who disregard fair competition principles do not benefit from a rigged bidding process targeting our communities and public institutions. The White House did not immediately respond to a question on Wednesday about why Mr. Trump had pardoned someone who was prosecuted by his own administration. The indictment against Mr. Luwiki accused him of killing a competing bid from a rival company to build the Moody Center Arena, which ultimately cost $375 million to develop. In exchange for getting the rival company to drop its competing bid, the indictment said, Mr. Luwiki promised to give the rival company kickbacks in the form of subcontracting work on the arena project. In the end, the rival company backed off, and Mr. Luwiki's company submitted the sole qualified bid to build the arena, according to the indictment. Mr. Luwiki ultimately reneged on the agreement after winning the contract, and Oakview Company did not award the promised subcontracts. In an email covered by investigators, Mr. Luwiki bragged after winning the contract that We were very clever to put together an agreement that scared everyone else away, adding that this allows us to dictate terms to the university. Oakview Group continues to manage and operate the arena and receives a cut of the revenue from the facility. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, now turning to New York State news in the next article. As Hochul considers an AI bill, its sponsor throws her a fundraiser. Governor Kathy Hochul received nearly $250,000 for her reelection campaign from donors eager to have her sign a bill that would regulate the AI field in New York. It was only a few days after announcing her first run for Congress, and Assemblyman Alex Borres was already gathering big money from donors. At a Midtown Manhattan restaurant, Mr. Borres was a co-host of a fundraiser that attracted a room full of software engineers and experts in artificial intelligence, many of whom support an AI-related bill passed by the New York State Legislature in June that was sponsored by Mr. Borres. The event on October 30th netted nearly $250,000 in political contributions, according to four people familiar with the matter. The money did not go to Mr. Borres. It went to the reelection campaign of Governor Kathy Hochul, who has until December 31st to decide whether to sign, modify, or veto Mr. Borres' bill. It was unusual for a young second-term assemblyman to host such an event for the governor, and even more atypical that Mr. Borres would have a bill before the governor, according to Blair Horner, the senior policy advisor at the New York Public Interest Research Group. There are no real restrictions on those who want to make donations who have business before the governor, Mr. Horner said. New York's system has improved, but it's still the Wild West in terms of fundraising. The campaign windfall to Ms. Hochul signals the importance of the AI bill as lawmakers around the country grapple with what type of guardrails might be needed for a rapidly advancing technology. It also underscores the willingness of stakeholders to spend heavily to influence potential legislation. The tech sector is increasingly the biggest economic growth sector here, so it only stands to reason that you would only see this dynamic at play in politics as well, said Julie Samuels, the president of Tech NYC, an industry association. In California, Governor Gavin Newsom signed a bill in September that forces the most advanced AI companies to report safety protocols and the greatest risk their technologies pose. These fights in state capitals have taken on an increased importance in the absence of federal standards around the safe development of the most advanced artificial intelligence models. At the same time, the Trump administration and some congressional Republicans have sought to prohibit states from regulating the technology. The bill in New York, known as the Responsible Artificial Intelligence Safety and Education Act, coined as RAISE, would require larger firms developing AI models to formulate and publicize safety plans for their most advanced products. If it becomes law, the legislation sponsored by the state Senate by Senator Andrew Guarnes would force companies to disclose major security incidents, such as when the models steal or engage in behavior other than at the request of the user. AI companies and their financial backers took sides. Bloomberg Industry reported over the summer that several venture capital firms We're spending about $40,000 a month to shape or kill the legislation. Ms. Samuels said her group had concerns about the bill's current language, and she has conveyed them to Ms. Hochul. The hope, Ms. Samuels added, is that changes to the Raises Act transparency provisions can be more closely aligned with the rules recently adopted in California, so there can be a single framework of compliance in the two America's largest cities. Money has also flown to and against Mr. Borges' nascent campaign to replace Representative Gerald Nadler, the former House Judiciary Chairman who is not seeking re-election. In the first 15 hours following the announcement of his campaign launch, Mr. Borges disclosed raising about $1.2 million, nearly twice as much as his closest competitors. It's unclear where the bulk of the money came from. Disclosures for this period won't be released until next year. His foes have taken note. A bipartisan super PAC funded so far with about $100 million from the founders of OpenAI and Andreessen Horowitz, a venture capital firm, among others, has targeted Mr. Borges and said it would spend at least $10 million against him. The New York Times reported last week that a group of people who work in and around the AI industry and fear what will happen if it is unregulated are hoping to raise at least $50 million to act as a counterweight and back candidates, including Mr. Borges. Ms. Hochul has met with a number of sector's leading figures and secured about $340 million in state funds for Empire AI, a public-private partnership aimed at making New York a key player in artificial intelligence research. She has also said there needs to be a balance between innovation and safety when it comes to these new technologies. Her efforts to place New York at the center of this growing field comes as she gears up for a primary fight against Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado and a likely general election battle against Representative Elise Stefanik, a pro-Trump Republican. The governor has raised about $4 million for her re-election in the first half of 2025, according to state disclosures, and about $17.5 million cash on hand. Governor Hochul evaluates all legislation based on the merits and makes determinations solely on what is best for New Yorkers. Cara Cumuletti, a spokesman for Ms. Hochul, said in a statement. The battles over AI regulation have also opened a spigot of campaign cash for local politicians like Mr. Borges, 34, who joined the state assembly in 2023 after working for several technology firms, including Palantir, which does extensive work for the federal government. Mr. Borges said in an interview that Ms. Hochul has a tough re-election coming up, and he chose to help raise money for her because she is one of the most forward-looking governors on AI in the country. There's a lot of money being spent against any AI regulation in government in general, and it's being done to overcome tremendous popular support for these provisions, Mr. Borges said. It's not surprising that of the people who support some regulation, some of them might also be interested in supporting candidates willing to stand up against big tech. Mr. Borges has cultivated a similar network of donors. Many are part of the Effective Altruism movement, which is made up of activists who are, among other things, concerned about the safety of AI. The ideology rose to prominence largely through the efforts of Sam Bankman-Fried, the founder of the FTX cryptocurrency exchange, who was sentenced to 25 years in prison after stealing billions of dollars from customers. Many of the donors invited to the Hochul fundraiser were proponents of effective altruism and had expressed concerns about the proliferation and unregulated AI. This is one of the few cases where the call is coming from inside the building. Nate Sorries, an AI researcher who was co-author of a New York Times best-selling book about the subject. He was invited to the Hochul fundraiser and has given to candidates from both parties whose views of AI align with his, including $1,000 to Ms. Hochul. A lot of people are donating money to politicians who are opposed by these $200 million PACs. A lot of them are people who work in the industry or used to and think it's really dangerous, he added. You have a lot of people saying that big oil is doing bad stuff, but you don't usually have people at oil companies saying this stuff is scary. Mr. Borey's co-host of Ms. Hochul's fundraiser was Jack O'Donnell, a longtime lobbyist whose clients include the Secure AI Project, a San Francisco advocacy group run by a proponent of effective altruism who used to work with Mr. Bankman-Fried. The organization supports the RAISE Act and is pushing to pass similar bills around the country. Okay, we have time for one more quick article. Air Force pilot ejects his Thunderbird's F-16 crashes in California. The pilot was in stable condition after losing control of the fighter jet near Trona, California, about 180 miles northeast of Los Angeles. An F-16 fighter jet with the U.S. Air Force Thunderbirds, the elite aerial demonstration team, crashed on Wednesday morning in a Southern California desert, with the pilot safely ejecting moments before impact. The pilot was in stable condition and receiving medical care, said Javante Johnson, an Air Force spokesman, said in an email on Wednesday. It was not immediately clear what caused the crash, which military officials said happened around 10:45 a.m. during a training mission over controlled airspace. The F-16 fighter Falcon struck a dry lake bed in the Mojave Desert near Trona, California, creating a plume of smoke and a boom that could be heard in the surrounding area, according to emergency responders and witnesses. The jet crashed about 2 miles south of the Trona Airport, but was not using the airport, George Bass, the facility manager, said in a phone interview. Military aircraft have a regular presence in the area, he said. A video circulating online appeared to show the pilot's parachute open just as the fighter jet burst into flames. As of 2021, the most recent estimates available from the Air Force, an F-16C cost $18.8 million. The Federal Aviation Administration referred questions about the incident to the military. The Thunderbirds are based in Nellis Air Force Base outside Las Vegas, which is about 200 miles east of the crash site. The unit is known for pushing the envelope with its death-defying maneuvers and precision at shows, which have drawn millions of spectators since the Thunderbirds were created in 1953. Just 18 inches separates the F-16 from each other during some maneuvers, which have names like the opposing knife edge pass and the Delta Loop. The crash was the second near Trona in recent years. In 2022, a Navy pilot was killed after his F-18 Super Hornet crashed in a remote, unpopulated area. The pilot, Lieutenant Richard Bullock, was flying a training mission, the Navy said. Thunderbird pilots, too, have been involved in several fatal crashes, including in 2018 when Major Stephen Del Bogno was killed while training in Nevada. At the time, he was performing a split S routine and lost consciousness and control of his F-16. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the December 4th issue of the New York Times. Your reader today has been Mark Greyer. Thank you for listening.